Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Sioux City State Representative Chris Hall is suing the state over the way money was handled in the budgeting process. The 3rd District Democratic Representative says he's concerned about financial issues and budgeting. Hall is alleging that Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and a top aide broke the law when they transferred $13 million from a reserve fund to balance the budget. The lawsuit was filed yesterday against Reynolds and Department of Management Director David Roeder. Hall is the ranking member on the House Appropriations Committee. The lawsuit claims that the legal conditions weren't met to trigger the governor's transfer authority, an argument that Reynolds has dismissed. Hall says he believes that keeping the state accountable financially is one issue Republicans and Democrats should be able to get together on as they approach the opening day of the legislative session on Monday.
The state budget process is the most important thing that state government does. Without it being in good shape, it means that your children's education, your parents' health care, I mean, all of those things start to unravel, and we've seen over the last year or two that a lot of those things are unraveling. We have a huge teacher shortage in the state of Iowa. We also have an imploding Medicaid system, and a lot of that is due to either decisions made by the executive branch and the governor or decisions that they've chosen to punt on, which then compound our financial situation even worse. So I hope that there's some political courage that we'll see demonstrated during the legislative session to address tough issues. We can't just continue to expect them to fix themselves or say that the economy is going to solve it for us. The reason that people were elected to hold public office is to make hard decisions and to do things that are for the best interests of the public. The longer we delay on them, the bigger the problems get.
Do you think that sometimes the whole budgeting process and how tax credits work and all of these things are so confusing for the average person, it's hard for them to really be upset because they don't know, it's hard to know what is really going on unless you've studied these issues quite a bit.
Right. And that's something that, you know, I've really tried to emphasize and discuss with my colleagues. When we're talking about these issues, it's hard for people to understand them as a budgetary process. But when you go home to your district and you're holding a forum on Saturday morning, and I can explain to people right now because of the budget, right now there are not enough people to actually conduct nursing home inspections and ensure that our seniors are safe. We are cutting preschool aid to children who otherwise won't be able to go to preschool. We are talking about tens of thousands of dollars of debt being borne on the backs of graduate students and kids in undergrad. When you put a factor to it that somebody's child is in a classroom that has 40 children in it right now, you know, all of these things are a consequence of failed budgeting. They all reach home and they all affect the citizens of this state. And sometimes you have to talk about who they're affecting and the populations that are actually being either cut or just not seeing very essential services. And unfortunately, it's usually the most vulnerable people in this state, whether it's disabled individuals, economically needy families and children, or seniors who are in the twilight years of life who are also suffering at home and potentially in private.
I think the whole issue of the privatization of Medicaid in Iowa has also been a tough one for some people to understand, like how this privatized system works. And a lot of the times when stories come out about people not getting services or not being able to get services in a timely manner, and the government, the state government will come out and say, look, you know, we're trying to iron out the wrinkles in the system. But it has been going on for some time.
The whole Medicaid privatization, people warned at the front end of it, including the federal government. They gave us several warnings and said the timeline that Governor Branstad was trying to put this into place was rushed. It was at odds with what every other state in the country has done and how they've pursued privatizing Medicaid. And everything that was made as a warning has unfortunately come true. We now have lost one of the companies, which forced over 200,000 Iowans to have to find health care on a very short timeline and have to also potentially find a new doctor or a new hospital for their primary care. And I also hear continually from small business owners about the trouble they're getting, having payments made on time, whether it's something like a hospital, Mercy or St. Luke's here in Sioux City, or something as small as a speech pathologist who is doing contract work for a school district. We've got small business owners who have actually been put out of business because these companies won't reimburse them. They won't actually pay for the services that are being provided out here. And if you start to see small businesses go under or nursing homes in rural parts of the state go under, it should be a real alarm that is raised and something that absolutely doesn't need to be and should not be a partisan issue. It's something that we all need to join together and fix. And Governor Reynolds, she needs to acknowledge that there is a problem and not just say that she's not willing to work on it either way.
Last year, one of the biggest stories coming out of the legislature had to do with sort of the collective bargaining system being basically almost zeroed out. It doesn't exist in the form that it once did. And this year, a lot of people are concerned about IPERS and the thought that IPERS, the way IPERS is configured and the way it's run might be changed, also given to private interest instead of the state. The state treasurer has been warning about this. What kind of efforts do you see made on this, on that particular project?
The reason people have a right to be concerned about IPERS and whether that will continue, you know, to exist in its current form is because the Republican legislature broke their promise last year on collective bargaining. They said they were going to make some minor tweaks. They were going to adjust a few things that weren't working. And I think they could have found bipartisan cooperation if we really were tweaking the system. But instead, they gutted it entirely and they threw teachers and plow drivers and public employees under the bus. And so for them to come back this summer, have a study conducted by an outside organization that has no ties to Iowa. In fact, it has ties to the Koch brothers and these wealthy billionaires who are privately funding Republican campaigns. For them to have a study conducted by this group and then tell us, oh, we're not going to make any changes, just isn't believable anymore. They cried wolf once last year and nobody believes it anymore. We expect that if they're telling us there's an issue and they've already gone to the trouble of having some outside group come in and study our system and what it would look like if it were privatized, I take that as an acknowledgement that they would like to change the system. And that is a huge issue for Iowa because hundreds of thousands of Iowans depend on their retirement security, and it comes in the form of IPERS. More than, $3 million comes to the city of Sioux City in the form of annualized retirement payments, and we're just one of many communities across the state that is like that.
Looking ahead to this session, do you think it will be, 2017 2.0, people feel like it's going to be a lot of the same sort of partisan type issue, people not being willing to work together?
I think that, or I'm at least hopeful, I really try to be an optimist, and I want for this session to be one where we are working together and hopefully addressing mainstream issues, not things that are out on the political fringe. I have great relationships with many colleagues on the other side of the aisle. And over the past few years, the biggest change that I've seen is how top-down their governance structure is. If the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader or Governor Reynolds says, we're addressing this issue, a lot of their members just fall in line and vote for it, even if it's a conflict of interest or something that they don't actually believe is right in their conscience. And we need to see some changes. We need to see rank-and-file legislators stand up with a little bit of backbone and say this is wrong and it's pushing the state in the wrong direction. And I hope to see that, and I also have encouraged privately some of my colleagues to try and think about it more in those terms.
Right. Well, is there anything else, any other issue you'd like to talk about?
Mental health care is a big issue right now and something that I think people are aware the system's not functioning properly. If you talk to law enforcement officers, they are often put in this situation of having to drive across state or try to find in a different corner of the state, as far as Keokuk or Burlington, an empty bed where you can put a psychiatric patient and give them the mental health care that they need. We can't be asking that of our law enforcement officers, and we also can't expect hospitals and jails, frankly, to be the repository for people who have mental health needs. It's not fair to them, and it's also not fair to taxpayers and public safety professionals.
Last year, water quality was a huge issue. You know, a lot of people showed up at public hearings to talk about water quality and how water, you know, who should be in charge of water quality.
Right. Water quality is an issue that's been lingering out there for several years right now. And I think there has at least come some acknowledgement both within rural and urban areas that we need to address it, and hopefully in a cooperative manner. This can't all be solved by filing lawsuits. It's something that, obviously, from a rural perspective, we want to ensure that soil health is there, and also helping farmers continue to have productive seasons, and something that's available for the next generation of farmers to inherit. The flip side of that is if you live in a bigger community, you're probably paying higher fees or you know, different utilities just to get certain chemicals out of your drinking water right now. And so, you know, if it's something so fundamental as the safety of drinking water, let alone recreational use, and the fact that lakes and ponds across the state have been closed for swimming over the last few summers, it's a real issue. It's something that people expect the state to address. They expect us to figure out a compromise and some middle ground. And it has to be something that's also sustainable and has enough funding to address the scope of the issue. This is something that is multi-billions of dollars of cost. And if we just try to band-aid it and we say, oh, here's an idea, and we throw a few million dollars at it that doesn't really do anything, it doesn't serve anyone's interest, and it means that we have to revisit it later. We're at a point in time where elected officials really have to demonstrate leadership. They have to be talking about these things, knowing that some of the solutions might not be politically popular, but hopefully they are a solution in true form and something that can be sustained for future years. That's what leadership needs to look like, and we're not seeing as much of it as I think personally I would hope, but I think a lot of other citizens feel the same too.
That was Chris Hall, the 3rd District State Representative from Sioux City. Hall is suing the governor of Iowa over her handling of the transfer of $13 million in emergency funding to meet deficits in the general fund. Reynolds' spokeswoman said in an email yesterday that this is a political lawsuit with political motivations, plain and simple. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Siouxland has a new Republican state senator that will soon be sworn in. Jim Carlin won a special election in December to take over the 3rd District seat through the end of this year. It was just last year that Sioux City Attorney Carlin won his 6th District House seat. Looking ahead to the coming session, Carlin says he and other Republicans believe the state needs to change its tax system to remain economically competitive, especially with neighboring states.
You know, one of the most basic realities of the economic well-being of a state is its ability to compete with its neighbors, because money always migrates to friendlier pastures, particularly for border cities like Sioux City that are disproportionately affected by South Dakota not having personal income tax or corporate income tax. And you know, by comparison, we have very high personal income tax rates and the second highest corporate tax rate. So we're not really on any kind of competitive footing. We have to come up with a plan that recognizes those realities, that money is going to migrate out of our state. And in fact, it certainly has in this part of the state. So to get economically healthy, you have to have a vision that goes out 10, 20, 30 years. Our small businesses are being dramatically affected by internet sales. And I think Iowa should look at some type of a sales tax on internet purchases, because if they can't compete, you know, if there's going to be a 7% tax on everything that's sold here in our small businesses, and you buy the same thing cheaper on the internet with no taxes, it's going to hurt us. And it has. Small businesses close up as a result of that. The taxation on pensions, you know, if your seniors get their pensions taxed, they're gonna go to Nevada, they're gonna go to Florida, and we are aging as a state, and that's not revenue we really want to lose. And there's a couple of issues related to the SAVE tax that I'm sure we'll talk about as well.
What do you think about trying to deal with the budget deficits the state has been having over the past few years? Some of the Democrats are saying they really believe it has to do with tax incentives given to outside companies. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Republicans, I guess one of our main credos is balance the budget. It always has been that way. Our Democrat colleagues don't seem to share that as a priority. We live within our means, and when you have an ag economy that is what it is right now, $3 for a bushel of corn, $9 for a bushel of soybeans, that has dramatic implications. You know, we're an ag economy. We're an ag-driven economy. So, I mean, it's kind of a overly simplistic way of assigning blame to try to get some political points, score some political points with the citizenry of Iowa, but it doesn't reflect the reality. Tax credits have generated economic growth in border cities like Sioux City, where we have targeted jobs. They do work. I think, though, in fairness, we need to look at how well they're performing. We need to see if the investment that we're giving is generating revenue for the state, and I think that's fair. But to just, you know, blame it wholesale on Republican tax credits, and by the way, a lot of Democrats vote for those tax credits, and it's just it's not even a remotely fair characterization of the realities of what's going on.
What about Medicaid privatization? There have been a lot of issues with it. People saying they are having trouble getting service. They're saying people who have really serious disabilities are having a problem finding, you know, basic help, people that will do the work for the amount the state is paying. What do you think the state can do to help deal with some of those problems?
You know, I think once you have people, you know, about 5% of the population base is responsible for about 50% of the overall budget. So you have 5%. And, you know, that 5% are people with cardiac issues, heart issues, diabetes, chronic illness. And when that, you know, disproportionately affects the cost of premiums to where we're now down to one provider in Medica, you're going to have to find some type of a stopgap measure, either through government subsidy of chronic illness and keep your private pay going and not put the burden of the chronic illness on those private pay carriers, because there's no incentive for them to be here. I mean, they have to make a profit. So if I say, you know, I want you to insure a car accident after it happens, and I'm not saying people are car accidents, but just by way of analogy, what are they insuring? It's not really insurance at all. You know, so, you know, you can either do some type of a government subsidy as a stopgap measure, or you can look at some type of a medical savings account platform for, you know, people that could carry health insurance for hospitalization or surgery or some of the more expensive big ticket type things, and then, you know, have a medical savings account that they can use to pay for doctor's visits, for x-rays, for chiropractic care, or, you know, basic preventative medicine type of care that will be paid for, and so it'll be encouraged for people to do those things. And I think overall that could be a way of getting the costs down. And I think we need to be a little bit more aggressive in our take on preventative medicine in Iowa as a whole. One of the ideas specifically that I think needs to be floated or looked at, or at least do a pilot study, is on applications of telemedicine to determine, you know, any morbidities that could be assessed and looked at to prevent long-term hospitalization or, you know, long-term nursing home care, those types of things. And if they're just addressed soon enough, then you can save a lot of money. I mean, a lot of the expense goes to those types of things. And so if we focus a little bit more on our preventative care, we, you know, in the long run, I think we're going to save a lot more money.
What do you think about fears people have, specifically Michael Fitzgerald, the state treasurer, about possibility of changing the IPERS system? Mm-hmm. Do you think that anyone will bring that up in this coming session, and do you think it's needed?
Right now, I think we rank 13th nationally in the solvency of our IPERS. We have $7 billion in unfunded pension liability. At some point, and I don't think it'll be this year, we're going to have to look at transitioning to a platform for new hires. You have to have integrity in the process, and I think you have to keep your word to the people that have worked for you and served the state. But in terms of the overall cost down the road, we're going to have to consider adopting a new model that reflects the economic realities of where we are as a state, what we can reasonably afford. And, you know, it's not something anybody wants to talk about, but, you know, down the road, if you want to have long-term sustainability of IPERS, I think you're going to have to transition to a model that will allow you to keep your commitments and, you know, get your pension, more in line with their private sector counterparts. So, and I think that's indispensable to the long-term survivability of IPERS itself. You know, you want to be able to keep your word to those people who are counting on you. And if you don't have the people paying in to sustain it, and you don't have the state resources to pay it 10, 20 years down the road, you know, something has to be done now. You can't wait for the dam to burst to try to do something.
Education funding is always a big issue. Seems like a K through 12 usually comes through somehow better than higher ed. Both are important, though. I mean, how do we balance like K through 12 and higher ed? These needs, especially workforce needs, are so important.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think we need to look at how the money is being spent. I mean, we spent $700 million on Regents, and we need to look at, you know, get a better handle on how that's being spent to justify that kind of an outlay. We added, I mean, K through 12 is the one area of education we didn't cut. We actually added $40 million, which, you know, incrementally is not that big an increase, maybe as big an increase as you'd want. But, what people don't realize is 46% of our budget, our general appropriations budget, goes to K through 12 education. That's a very large chunk of the budget. And, as it should be, I mean, it should be a priority, in terms of how much growth and what is economically feasible for the state. I think you always have to look for ways to cut waste and look for areas of waste that can be cut, and at the same time meet your obligations to educate the children of Iowa. I also think we need to look at, you know, giving parents who pay those same taxes, the same sales tax, the same property tax, the same income tax, when 77% of their taxes goes towards education, they should have a say on some level. There should be choice in education, I think. And if they want to enroll their kids in a private school, I think some provision for tax savings accounts or some type of a voucher system needs to be in place. If they, you know, if you pay, you should have something of a say. And the taxes that you should pay shouldn't be a deterrent to educating your kids the way you want to, or even be perceived as penalizing you from that pursuit. So.
Right. There's also a push on the Republican side to do something about water quality and try to make some strides in that this mm-hmm. year. Mm-hmm. I know in the Senate that they've been, some of the senators have been talking about that in their off time. Now you're going to be a senator. You've been elected. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the proposal, or do you have any ideas of your own?
Last year, we had a Senate bill and we had a House bill. And actually, the Senate bill was the previous year's House bill, or was it 2 years before? You might actually know that better than I.
It's a little confusing.
It is. But whatever we come up with has to reflect and protect the family farmers of Iowa. Right now, they're not making, I mean, their profitability, their sustainability. Some of the real concerns I have are whether or not banks are going to be willing to lend them the money they need to keep the family farm going. And if you add to their burden to run the family farm, that could really hurt Iowans, or, hurt the ag economy even more than where it is. So it's got to be something that I think is farmer friendly. The technologies, I think, are pretty well established. So it comes down to funding and how we're going to fund it. And, I guess from my own perspective, I would lean towards a water bill that recognizes the economic realities of Iowa's farmers.
That was Jim Carlin, the newly elected 3rd District State Senator for Siouxland. Carlin is taking his seat and leaving behind an open 6th District House seat. As of today, there are two candidates for that office. They are Rita DeJong, a Democrat and former Sioux City teacher and principal, and Jacob Bossman, a Republican who lost a bid for that Iowa House seat back in 2016 when Carlin won the position. The election is set for January 16th. After floating the possibility of running last week, Jake Jungers of Sioux City won't run as a minor party candidate for that seat. Jungers tried to win a city council seat last fall. The winner of the January 16th election will fill the last year of Carlin's 2-year House term. Carlin, a first-term Republican, defeated Democrat Todd Wendt of Lamar's 55-45% for that Senate District 3 seat. The vacancy was created by the resignation of 2-term Senator Bill Anderson, a Pearson Republican who in September accepted a job heading the Cherokee Area Economic Development Corporation. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. In Iowa, there are several issues facing lawmakers as the legislative session begins on Monday. Joyce Russell of Iowa Public Radio says this year looks like it will be another session plagued by budget deficits and the need to make cutbacks.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be another tight budget year. There's no doubt about that. As you probably know, the revenue estimates have been reduced twice since the beginning of the fiscal year. They passed a budget covering this fiscal year that ends in June. And one of the first things they're going to have to do is come in and cut some from this year's budget because the revenues haven't come in at the level that the budget was based on.
Where do you think they'll be making those cuts?
Well, that'll be part of Governor Reynolds' recommendations. The legislature comes in on Monday, and then Tuesday will be, as usual, the condition of the state address. The governor will release her budget on Tuesday, and that will normally, it's a budget for the next fiscal year, and she will be doing that. But in addition, she's expected to make recommendations for how to make some cuts in this year's budget. And the further along you get into the fiscal year, the less you have, really, the fewer your choices are. So the fiscal year is already just about half over. And so she will almost certainly make some selective cuts. And when, rather than an across-the-board cut, which would also be her prerogative, but she'll have to find some places to cut the budget. And in general, you may recall last year there were some pretty significant cuts with not very much time left in the fiscal year. And the bigger your budget is, the more likely you are to get to get cut. You know, if you take a tiny budget like, oh, let's say the Public Information Board, they're so small, they can't absorb any cuts. So that's where the universities, for example, really got hit last year. When the governor had to come in and cut that year's budget.
What do you think about Medicaid privatization? A lot of concerns, a lot of complaints about it. Do you think there's anything lawmakers might do or anything the governor might do?
Governor Reynolds has made very clear, as the criticism has mounted, and I should say there's even in recent months criticism from members of her own party. You know, legislators are hearing complaints from their constituents, whether it's patients and their advocates or healthcare providers who've complained that the new for-profit managers are not coming through paying their bills on time. And so the criticism has started to come even from Republicans. But Governor Reynolds has made very clear, she says, it's not perfect. I never said it was going to be perfect. And everything that she has said publicly is that she's behind this, and she's not likely to make any recommendations for change.
I was talking with the state treasurer, Michael Fitzgerald, after he had come out and made his concerns known again about the IPERS plan, the state public employees pension plan, and how he's worried that lawmakers might do something to gut that, as he feels they did last year with collective bargaining. What do you think the likelihood is that they might introduce something about changing IPERS?
Well, I think that advocates for public employees are nervous about that, and for the very reason that you just mentioned, that going into the session last year, Republicans were publicly saying, the leaders were publicly saying, we're going to tweak collective bargaining, and that turned out to be absolutely not the case. So even though the leadership and the people in the key positions to have something to say about this are saying they're not going to make significant changes to IPERS, some, like I said, public employees and their advocates are not trusting that. However, for example, Senator Schneider, who is this key person overseeing that in the Senate, he has said he has no intention of making of introducing a bill. Of course, what we're talking about is to change IPERS to a kind of, instead of a defined benefits program, to change it to something more like the private sector 401k.
Last year was such a big rollover for Republicans getting to do all these things they hadn't been able to do for a while. They passed so many initiatives sort of overwhelmingly because they had so much power. Well, they still have a lot of power. Do you think it will become again a very partisan kind of thing this year?
Oh, yes. I think it will continue along the same vein. You know, the one thing that they said they wanted, that they said all along that they wanted to do major tax cuts, rolling back income taxes, for example. And last year, they're simply, number one, there wasn't enough money in the budget to do that, and that may still be the case this year. And number two, you know, if you look at all the things that they did last year, collective bargaining on the top of it, gun control, abortion restrictions, all of the things, that was that pent up appetite for among Republicans. You know, at some point, there's only something you can do in one session. So there's a great deal of interest in a major tax cut bill. But again, I think the budget is going to be a determining factor. I think the most likely thing that's going to happen there is they're going to pass them a major tax bill and put it off into the future so that it wouldn't be a hit on the budget right away.
And Republicans, some of them I've talked to around here, say they're interested in really doing something about water quality that won't hurt farmers this year. And I don't know that all Democrats think that that particular bill is the best idea, but it seems like there's a big push to try and deal with water quality in general.
Yes, and I'm expecting that they will pass some kind of long-term bill to fund water quality initiatives. The difference the difficulty with that right now is that House and Senate have passed different versions of that. And the House up to now, both Republican bills, the House up to now has insisted on more accountability and transparency and accountability as far as how the money is going to be used and whether and spend it in ways that you know you're going to get results. To say, for example, focus on a particular watershed and get everybody cooperating on how to get, you know, get the nitrates out of the water in this area and that area and that area. The bill that the Senate passed had less, you know, critics would say had less accountability in it. And so those are the, that's the sticking point. Before the Republicans were all in control, the sticking point was how to pay for it. And Democrats don't want to take money out of the other, you know, take money away from education or human services to pay for water quality. But that's the approach that the Republicans are taking. It would be a big spending for water quality over the next many years, but it would just be diverting that from other resources in the budget.
Yeah, Joyce, is there anything else you'd like to mention you think will be important this year?
I think that the legislature will almost certainly do something with the opioid epidemic. There's a lot of attention to that. We filed a story this week. One of our reporters filed a story this week that, for example, they're expecting 200 opioid-related deaths in Iowa in the upcoming year. They had a lengthy two-day interim committee on this, hearing from every conceivable angle. So there will almost certainly be something to address the opioid epidemic this year.
That was Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell talking about the legislative session that begins Monday in Des Moines. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. South Dakota is set to begin its legislative session on Tuesday. The short session will end by the end of February. Sioux Falls Argus Leader reporter Dana Ferguson gives us a preview.
What we've heard from the governor so far, and this came earlier this year, earlier this month actually, at his budget address, is that he wants to find essentially some funds from other agencies and departments that are sort of laying around or that are possibly usable to fill about a $34 million shortfall for the current budget year that runs through June 30th. And he said, we're having a difficult budget year that is stemming from a slow farm economy. We're not seeing the revenues that were projected as far as sales tax coming in. The state for a while now has said that is coming in large part from lost revenue that is going to online retailers that are not remitting sales tax. They're very optimistic that that's something they'll be able to figure out, but not right away. So for now, Governor Dugard has said that he wants to shore up the $34 million necessary to fill that hole with funds that are essentially lying around. And then for fiscal year 2019, he said he's going to have a pretty lean budget. State employees are not expecting any sort of raise for the second year in a row. And spending to agencies and departments will be pretty consistent with what we've seen. No big growth almost anywhere, with the exception of more funding to education, and that's really to fill sort of a hole there that has been caused by more students than were expected in some of the state's larger school districts.
Well, I know there's a continuing battle over these ballot initiatives. You had so many of them in South Dakota. And there's a continuing controversy over what to do about them.
You're right. As you recall, last year was a very big year for ballot measures. You and I talked about just how many were on the ballot, the 10. We will likely see quite a few next year, but it won't be quite that many. In the meantime, legislators are going to take up that question again of exactly how much power voters should have when they go out to the polls and essentially what threshold is required to pass a constitutional amendment or a law. There have been lawmakers who've said they don't like how much influence out-of-state groups are having on policy in the state, so they're going to aim to curb the influence of out-of-state groups that spend money on ballot measures. That is a very timely effort. We saw last year many groups that poured millions of dollars into South Dakota to influence voters. One of those groups was successful and passed Initiated Measure 22, which had to do with ethics and campaign finance law. As you recall, that was struck earlier this year in the legislature, and lawmakers are going to look to put some of those pieces into law potentially next year.
In the next legislative session, it looks like there's going to be an effort to do something about the juvenile justice system.
So the juvenile justice system, I believe about 2 years ago, the state did a fair amount of research to look at what was working and what wasn't working. When juveniles are convicted of crimes, what was keeping them in jail or out of jail for some minor crimes. And they amended the state's laws to enable more community-based support for those young people who are committing nonviolent crimes. Now, about 2 years after the fact, the governor has said that's largely working well, but there are some places where that system could be shored up a little bit. There are instances that we've seen across the state where young people are committing crimes, nonviolent crimes, but repeatedly. And there are some lawmakers who feel like there aren't punishments or any sort of efforts that are sufficient right now to prevent those sorts of crimes from occurring again. They're seeing recidivism that's higher than they like, so they're going to try to figure out what would be a path forward that would prevent some of those repeat crimes.
What about teacher salaries? Will there be another effort to raise those?
I don't see lawmakers trying to bump up teacher pay any further than they did back in 2016. What we can expect, though, is an effort to shore up the education funding formula. Just earlier this month, the Committee on Appropriations got together and had to decide whether to discipline school districts that weren't able to meet targets for teacher pay. And for various reasons, small districts weren't able to get there. Chief among them was declining enrollment. So there were just under a dozen school districts that had to go back and renegotiate teacher contracts with an eye toward paying them even more than they'd expected. Appropriators said they didn't really like the system that had been set up. They didn't appreciate only having two options, which were pushing those districts back into negotiations or asking them or essentially saying they could not receive half the funding, new funding they'd get from the state. So I would anticipate there will be a move to find some sort of solution there that is maybe less stringent on school districts that can't make those targets work.
I see that South Dakota, like Iowa, like a lot of states, plans on having some kind of sexual harassment training next month when everyone gets back to town. And I know that the leader had written several stories about women who had come forward and talked about their you know, moments of being harassed at the state level.
Certainly. And I agree with you. I don't think South Dakota and Iowa are alone in that regard. I think many state legislatures are going back this year and making sure that lawmakers and staff members understand what sexual harassment looks like and how they can prevent it. Lawmakers in South Dakota are going to be getting a training from the National Conference on State Legislatures, which in theory should be a pretty thorough training. They, I would think, know what they're talking about. And that desire to re-educate lawmakers comes after the Argus leader reported earlier this year that dozens of women who have worked in peer as lawmakers, lobbyists, and other staff members have experienced a culture of sexual harassment there, from having unwanted comments made to them or unwanted touches with other lawmakers. Essentially, just they were made to feel uncomfortable in a place that was supposed to be a very professional environment. So I think some of that reporting certainly encourage lawmakers to make this a focus again. As you'll likely recall too, earlier this year, a state lawmaker had to step down after he acknowledged that he'd had sexual contact with two previous interns in prior legislative sessions. So I think this conversation will be one that certainly comes up in 2018, and I would anticipate lawmakers might bring additional rules or legislation that deals with sexual harassment in the workplace.
Are there any other issues that you think will be important in the upcoming session?
Just to name a couple of them, we can expect that Representative Mark Mickelson out of Sioux Falls is going to bring an effort to ban collective bargaining among public faculty members. It's something that he has been working on for a couple months now. He was successful in bringing a similar measure earlier this year, I think, that also banned unions at tech schools. Additionally, I would anticipate that we're going to hear about resolutions or bills that have to do with South Dakota's stance on federal immigration policy. We have a couple lawmakers who have been very supportive of President Trump and his policies on immigration. They brought some measures last year that would have given the legislature veto power over any sort of refugee placements in the state. That measure was amended significantly before it was later passed, but a measure like that could certainly come up this year. Again, I anticipate there will be quite a bit of conversation about initiated measures and exactly how much power voters should have, and a little bit of a lesser known issue that lawmakers went into a special session earlier this year about, and we'll talk about again, is the concept of non-meandered waters, which are essentially bodies of water that weren't mapped out early on in the state's development, and now landowners and sportsmen are grappling with who should get access to those. And it'll be up to the legislature to decide whether they want to change the rules that they set earlier this summer, or if they want to start from scratch and find a new agreement as to who can use those waters.
That was Dana Ferguson, a reporter for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, talking about the South Dakota legislative session that begins on Tuesday. Nebraska's legislative session begins today. It's also a short one. Governor Pete Ricketts says the state budget is his top priority. The state faces a projected $173.3 million shortfall. Ricketts and key lawmakers say they intend to adjust the budget without raising taxes. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. We'll see you next Wednesday at noon. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mary Hartnett.